The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Pete gets manipulative and can't take it, so he lies about lying. Rand gets a vision for vision at DARPA. Another pitcher fills us with their fluid pitch. More fraud, spies, and lies, and possibly even another story or two from Chris and Fred. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Enterprise Leadership Network provides an intimate forum for C-level executives to gather and discuss key issues of the day. ELN is about building community, innovation, and collaboration with other ambitious, high-performing enterprise leaders through the exchange of ideas and information. You'll be able to participate in roundtable discussions, intimate in-person conferences, networking dinner events in your area, and a national forum. When you join Enterprise Leadership Network, you are welcomed into the fold of a private network of C-suite, senior executives, and accomplished VPs where you can build a solid network of peer relationships, carve out an executive career path, build your executive presence, and learn how to become a leadership and executive influencer. As an angel-to-exit portfolio company, other portfolio companies enjoy special privileges and access to ELN events. Take advantage of this unique opportunity to build relationships, grow your company, and affect positive change by attending and participating or sponsoring these outstanding networking events. To join other executives, become a member at ELN3.com today and grow your executive network.
Join ELN in Carlsbad, California on February 6th. Go to ELN3.com and press join now. This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Hi, I'm Marcus Suri, founder and CEO of OD Vision, Inc., makers of Tricorder Zero, the tricorder for telehealth and fitness. To our knowledge, Tricorder Zero will be the first ever fully integrated seven-sensor health and fitness device that enables the full potential of telehealth and telefitness. We've been seen in numerous publications, and we're solving two problems. First, 30 million Americans have no health insurance, and 40% of Americans can't afford to see their doctors. Well, the first solution is the device itself. It's a seven-sensor health and fitness tracker that will allow people to track their health and fitness without the need of a doctor. There's a high magnification camera for the outer eye and skin, a retractable camera for the ear, nose, and throat, an IR thermometer, a pulse oximeter, a body fat and muscle tone sensor, a stethoscope, and an EKG. Other problem is that telehealth is currently just a FaceTime call that limits patients' quality of care. Physicians don't have enough insight when limited to a patient's subjective complaints, so they're limited in prescribing drugs, ordering tests, and/or referring to specialists. The missing objective sensor data means that patients are often asked to come into the office for a full evaluation, which is wasting billions of dollars each year. Initial primary care telehealth visits have a higher rate of in-office follow-up than initial in-office visits because only 18% of all telehealth augments the audio call with medical equipment, and 4% of calls have equipment automatically sending data to providers. The second solution is using Tricorder Zero with its white-labeled and in-house telehealth platform along with the device itself. Independent practitioners can increase the efficiency and profits via holistic telehealth as triage. Insurance companies can increase profits by optimizing prevention and early detection and reducing payouts. And hospital systems increase profits by maximizing high-value ER visits and hospital admissions. As you can see, we have numerous concepts patent pending, and we've also recently been provided a patent for AI-assisted touchless blood pressure determination. So we've already proved demand for the device by collecting emails from ads that we sent out on social media. It costs us about $3 to get an email, and we are planning to collect 100,000 emails based on this funding round of $300,000 we're already raising on WeFunder, and that will allow us to collect 5,000 orders on our eventual Kickstarter campaign. That means a $60 marketing cost with a $40 profit per $300 device. So the market has already validated this concept. TidoCare as a device, MyMD as an AI symptom diagnosis engine, and MD Live as a multi-specialty telehealth app, combined, still don't provide all of the features of Tricorder Zero, but they get close and they all have many users. So the market opportunity here is huge. The 2028 total worldwide connected telehealth market will be $1 trillion. And we believe we can have a 25% global market share. So we've accomplished a lot in our timeline in the past couple of years. We went from design progression to 3D modeling to a breadboard, transitioning to a device prototype, programming our app prototype, and then getting the device and app prototype working together. As I mentioned, we have 12 plus patents pending, a design patent, as well as the first touchless blood pressure determination patent. We had completed our app shell, completed our sensor programming, our device and app programming. We even completed a venture accelerator program in March of 2023 and have completed our ad testing as well. So here's some information about me. I have made a concerted effort to obtain education, certifications, and skills very relevant to the exact startup that I'm heading at the moment, and I hope you'll agree with that. And more importantly, or equally importantly, I have advisors who have very deep domain expertise in their various fields. So our business model is essentially a B2B and B2C hybrid. What we're attempting to do is have a Kickstarter campaign to collect orders and then use that as validation to allow us to get larger orders from our real customers, which will be insurance companies. So when we prove to the insurance companies that the end user is actually paying out of their own pocket for a device that the insurance company should be providing to them at no cost because it benefits the insurance company to the tune of billions of dollars, we believe the insurance companies will be placing large orders with us going forward. So we have numerous exit options. We could have an IPO, sale to big tech, pharmacy, big insurers, hospital conglomerates, medical device companies, or just sale or license our IP. So far out of our, I believe we have over 60 investors now, we have 17 physician investors, numerous repeat investors, investors from seven countries, and two of our WeFunder investors have already doubled their investment during the campaign. So the train is moving, and let's go on this journey together. Thank you for your time.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Full of double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their G-Wiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. United Nations workers in Gaza have been fired for actively participating in terrorist operations as part of Hamas. Meanwhile, the World Court has cited reports written by and with many of these same people in its ruling regarding Israel's actions in Gaza. Meanwhile, news organizations worldwide are reporting false stories created by reporters who are part of Hamas's disinformation campaigns. And that's breaking news, but not on the Cyber Show.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Here's Chris and Fred in an extended discussion.
If something really sticks with me today, in the middle of a meeting that I was arguably running, Somebody came by that I've met once before, a guy named Al, who spent 50 years on the water here in the Florida Keys, you know, as a fishing guide and various other things. And we talked before once. He came back and had a passing conversation. I think plays into a lot of this because he's seen the seagrass die. He's seen the environment change. He's seen the fish go away. You know, he's personally watched this day to day his entire life. And he's worried, right? And he's skeptical that we can fix it. But we've already talked once about my thoughts on smart boats. And I'm saying to him, it's like, look, 10, 20, 30 years from now, that little boat you have right there, you know, nice little boat, it will have sensors on it. There's no reason the data from those sensors, which it needs just to operate, isn't used to save the seagrass. Right. Right now, the way we get data on the seagrass in these millions of acres of water out here is like steampunk. Right. Somebody goes out, every 75th Wednesday with a teacup.
No. It's not like the steam pump. It's more like the carry buckets of water up the hill from the river.
Right. So to your point about the change in kind, what happens when there's so much information? If you're responsible for the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission to save the seagrass in Florida, and you have so much data, every vessel on the water is pumping data to you all the time. You know the state of everything, as opposed to the way you do it now with a shovel.
This goes to the same discussion we've been having about the closer you look, the more you see. Right. And the more you can look at, the more you see. So it's in both dimensions, right? Both in increased quantity and increased depth of detail, right? Increased fidelity, increased quantity. It's going to make a qualitative change in our ability to think about things. And when I say our ability to think, I don't mean yours and mine. I mean the joint organism that is the cybernetic world of humanity plus all the technology that we live in.
Right. And it's always hard to think past that, right? But it again, this is where I get my whole inevitability lifelong focus, because to me, and particularly as these things evolve, like people like Ron, you and I get involved in these small groups that early on figure out some things that later on spread. And if we can have a little bit better vision of where we're going.
I'm going to fix that right now, Chris. Here's a future vision. Here, as a futurist, I'm going to answer your question. Human beings, for some perhaps hundreds or thousands of years, are going to become automated reproductive machines working for the cybernetic systems of the world to make sure that they continue to have maintenance. And our main job is going to be to reproduce with the proper size and shape of beings that is necessary to service the next generation or whatever, until the systems get good enough to not need us anymore. And then if we're really lucky, we'll be pets.
Star Wars versus Star Trek.
Well, no, neither one of them have that.
Well, I know, but I think, again, it just doesn't come down to that. I think what we find is that, the things we value as individual human beings are all that matters in the universe, frankly, right? Machines don't care. Stars are beautiful, but they don't care. And we'll just continue to refine what it is we want to do with our lives and our time. And I think this, I think the era from the Industrial Revolution to now is in some ways, in the long term, thousands of years in the future, this is still part of it. We're the late Industrial Revolution. We've gone from, community, agrarian, and so on and so forth, to structured manufacturing, engineering. And we're still stuck in that sort of box where we think, all right, it's a cogs machine. Again, like Ron in military, in the last century, we're going to take human beings, we're going to teach them how to be machines so they can be a machine cog in this greater machine. I think what we'll find is that, machines are used for humans to do things. And those
I think 150 years from now, when I arrange for my eighth brain to be augmented in my fourth arm on body number six, I think that I'm really going to be more servicing the cybernetic organism that is the joint being of all of us, as opposed to some independent, minutia little bag of goo and water that's walking around for its own purposes.
I know we wandered way off the radio show topic, but this is an interesting one. So Jeremy at the Textron, the sales guy, called yesterday, and so we've done got our work done. We're talking about things, and I was explaining what he's selling. It's the nature of the show. It's an optimistic, forward-looking sort of thing. Be part of it, lead people forward, as opposed to a Howard Stern or whatever it is. and we're debating.
That was my optimistic perspective.
I know.
That was the good one, right? Wait, the dark side is much worse.
But it's fascinating as an individual. If I'm getting to know Jeremy, he's becoming a friend of mine. But also as another example, because everybody does this. It's like, well, I just can't see us getting out of this, right? You know, the world's coming to an end, basically, right? You know, Ukraine war, World War, AI, whatever it is.
Come on. It's the end of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
Right. And my point to him is that no, in 30 years, Florida will be here. You know, in 1,000 years, the sun will come up. There'll be people here, right? And the whole wipe out the human species thing. And again, I believe this most of my life, but, you know, you finally just do the math. It's like it takes a deep impact comet strike to actually wipe out the humans so we're not here a billion years from now and 10,000 years from now. You leave a million of us around, in 300 years, we'll just repopulate the planet. It doesn't change anything.
So that won't work, by the way. The comet strike, unless it literally splits the planet in half and completely wipes out, you know, things to the core.
Yeah.
I mean, because, I mean, it's not even a million. I mean, 100,000 could probably do it. But,
right.
You know, we have another similar thought was the idea that we're going to get over the threshold where we can't fix it. And I believe it's possible to do that.
Sure.
But I also believe that, you know, with the cleverness that we have, with the capabilities that we have, with the knowledge that we have, that we can probably fix almost anything that we break. However, I the other side of me says that just because we can doesn't mean we will, right?
Well, but the other side.
And therefore, I say, don't look up. Let me reiterate, don't look up.
Well, it's funny. One of the, and I don't know if there's different disinformation actors have done anything with this or not, or whether it's just a popular phenomenon, but, you know, the number of headlines I see for asteroid near miss Earth thing over the last decade have just go straight through the roof. You know, I think people are fascinated with that. It's going to kill us. And it's like, look, even if an asteroid hits the Earth, it better hurry up, because you got like 50 to 100 years to wipe us out with an asteroid before there's people living on the moon and Mars who will sit there and watch the Earth be destroyed and go on and have little puppies and repopulate the universe anyway, right? You know that we're all based on 200 people from 70,000 years ago, you know, whatever, right?
It might be more like 250 years. I don't know. It depends on how quickly we, you know, go that route and how well we get there. But yeah, you're right that it's not a million years from now, unless we do extraordinarily stupid things, which we are capable of.
Which we are capable of.
But unless we do, yeah, by a couple hundred years from now. So normally the time frames for these big strikes are millions of years, right?
Yeah. So statistical odds of hitting that little window, not good. You know, somebody was just, you know, Jeremy was talking about the one 10, 15,000 years ago, you know, and saying, yeah, that was real. Absolutely. You know, the Earth gets hit with all sorts of shit. But that doesn't wipe out the species. That was like a little blip in the population curve, you know, now. But, you know, so yeah, I mean, and it's a cop out. It's the same thing as religion. And, you know, it's like, the same thing with childhood, and, you know, the smart aliens will come and solve all our problems, or there's no future, so we don't have to worry about our problems. My point is, like, no, we actually have to solve all these problems, because people will still be here thousands of years from now, and if we don't solve the problems, they'll still be here.
Well, so there are larger phenomena than the comet strike that, you know, are feasible, that can happen, that are, you know, much more devastating. I mean, we would not survive, you know, some of these things. And they're going to happen eventually. And the question is, how far will we get before then?
Yep.
Which has, you know, everything to do with, you know, how fast we can get from here to a lot of other places, right? Because these things happen all over the place. I think we're looking at certainly thousands of years before we end up populating, you know, say 100 planets that are in different solar systems.
Yeah, probably. But I managed to watch the Starship launch, the second launch last weekend on Saturday morning. And of course, Elon Musk.
The second explosion. Yeah. It got further.
Elon, when I started geeking on SpaceX, I didn't know much about Elon Musk. Now I don't really like anything I know, however, right? You know, he's not actually engineering the rockets. You know, there are teams of people doing this, right?
Right. He's just the money.
The launch was freaking amazing, right? And this, you know, it's like so many other things. That individual vehicle changes everything so much over the next 5 years that it's hard to even imagine. because
I don't think so.
The size and the scale and the, you know, compared that to Artemis, I saw the Artemis launch, you know, in person. It was beautiful. But, you know, we're talking about mass manufacturing, you know, launch vehicles that are exponentially larger than everything else. And that means you can carry things that are of a size and volume. But, and again, it's not about SpaceX as such. It's we're in this era right now. I grew up watching individual launches. I'd stay home from school to watch a launch because Earth launched something. Now we're like...
Yeah, the evolution of space technology... Yeah, the evolution of space technology is very substantial, right? And that's going to change everything. But I don't think that, you know, this particular company is the issue.
I'd love to see somebody else doing the same thing, at least for now, and hopefully not for terribly long. But yeah, that, you know, the Falcons are bloody amazing, right? Just... You know, the autonomy, the tech of it, and the pace, and being able to put things up that fast, that easy, that reliably, no failures ever, right? Recover most everything. This next generation of ships, you know, we get past the idea of building an aircraft carrier and sending it out for one mission and blowing it up and blah, blah, blah. And it just, like we're talking about with so many other things, it's the change in scale is a change in time. It's,
yeah, well, I'm waiting for the elevator because, you know, I think that's going to be a better path up to the ring. The elevator to the ring. And, you know, again, this all has to do with the investment in medical technology so we can live long enough to do it.
Yep. When I was a kid, I was totally into cryopreservation. Right? I remember saying it to my mom, and she was totally, you know, just horrified by the idea. Her point was she'd wake up, you know, cured of cancer 200 years from now, everybody she knows dead. Now, when I'm a kid, I'm, you know, 6-7 years old. I wasn't thinking that way. I'm thinking... Well, when I get old, I can freeze my brain and I'll wake up in the sci-fi future. But I'm still not against it. I don't know. If I just die, I don't have it set up, it's obviously not going to happen. But
I'm going to die, and when I'm dead, I'm not going to care. But until then, you know, here I am. Why am I? I'm not looking to die. Right. In fact, I have a responsibility to continue to do what I believe to be good for the world. And so I will continue to do that. Or I'll just retire and, you know, go fishing or something, which it just doesn't seem like it's for me, right?
I don't know. I was thinking about that earlier today. Right?
You cannot complete the task, but you're not allowed to quit.
Right.
Cognitive Defense is an emerging company helping other companies defend against malicious influence operations. They do this by helping people better defend themselves against exploitation. You can get in touch with Cognitive Defense by going to cogdef.com, that's cogdef.com, or find them through their link at thecybershow.co.
Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show.
Well, just when you thought it was safe to go back onto the internet, last week I did something foolish on the show. I told people that internet frauds were going down. Naturally, a significant part of our audience found that puzzling, and that part of our audience decided they would demonstrate that they were not going away. So here we have a new version of a fraud brought to you by Challenging the Threat. Yes, gentle folks, unless you have a desire to get hacked upon, don't ever tell the hackers you are not seeing enough of them. They may well accommodate you by redoubling their efforts to meet the challenge and increase their focus on you because it's fun. This week, I know you're a pedophile. Yes, that good old extortion scheme focused on people who perhaps should be extorted.
Important message for...
The email address goes here.
I know that you are a pedophile. I know about your interest in young children. I also know that you like to watch pictures and videos of children. Some time ago, when you looked at porn videos, you downloaded a virus to your device.
Okay, note, there's no specific date. It was just some time ago. So they're just trying to, you know, throw out a web for anybody that's a sucker enough to listen to them. If they were really watching what you were doing, they would have a specific date and time and all the other information.
This virus enabled me to connect from a distance and take over the full control over your device and your camera.
Of course they're going to use a computer virus. Why not? It's feared. It's credible. And on a personal note, I appreciate the reference.
I also downloaded a contact list for your family and work colleagues.
Of course, the pretext for any extortion is the threat that they're going to do something harmful to you. And this is the hint.
I caught you several times how you watched pornographic videos with children, and I recorded the entire incident.
Okay, so now it's an incident. and they have the entire incident, which is, you know, you all wouldn't want just a part of it. You want to make sure you have the whole thing for all the context so you can show it to all your friends and family, apparently.
I have secured a copy of your webcam video with your face and body as well as your device screen capture, naked children.
In an attempt to get more specific, the extortionist is claiming your naked body and children. One of the problems here, of course, is that they're narrowing the scope of the target audience so that if you didn't do those particular things, you're now saying it's a fraud. Generally speaking, it's probably better if you're going to be a fraudster to be sufficiently generic, sort of like a fortune teller, so that everything you say is credible regardless of the particulars of their circumstance.
I am the member of Hacker Group Anonymous.
Okay, so here's a real problem. The problem is twofold. One of them is they're claiming to be from the Hacker Group Anonymous, and this is sort of known around the world as bad guys and so forth, except they're not really bad guys. Well, they are, but they're more protesters. They have a tendency to only go against, we'll call it, deserving targets. Not that pedophiles aren't deserving targets. The problem is, for a generic scheme like this, they've now told the actual members of Anonymous that they're using the Anonymous name for something that's a fraud scheme, not for something that's actually trying to achieve justice. So at this point, the members of Anonymous, who I presume some of them are members of our audience, should be interested in tracking this person down for defaming them. So anybody from Anonymous, if you're interested, send me an email. I'll be happy to provide you with the details of the IP address of the sender and all the other information so you can track them down and, you know, cause them to pay for the misuse of your name.
With such incriminating evidence of your sexual fantasies, I am confident that I can ruin your life.
I really enjoy using this particular British accent for these things because it's such a reasoned and pleasant thing to enjoy ruining somebody's life.
I have 4 videos of you clearly while watching 2 videos of children.
So how exactly are you going to prove that you have these videos?
z_bsbtway_17058079.mp4, 25.1 megabytes, z_bsbtway_17052.
Obviously, you're going to prove it by naming a file name, which is MP4, and asserting a length of the video. I think that's one of the most bizarre things. As a basis for proof that you have something, I hardly think that that's going to be a good one. And furthermore, the file names, the numbering on the file names, don't seem to me to be implicative of a particular date and time or anything else, which is fairly common in the collection of MP4 videos. They'll have a name associated with the date and time or some such thing. So I'll say not very convincing, but on the other hand, you know, the folks that are going to react to this email, that's probably as convincing as you need to get.
If you want me to forget the whole thing, you have to pay me £2,500.
Okay, so you really have to be of a weak mind to believe that by paying somebody £2,500, they're going to, forget the whole thing. It never happened. I mean, if I'm an extortionist, why would I stop there? Well, that's £2,500. I'll ask for another £2,500 in the next couple of days. Why not?
I know that is a lot of money, but that's the price for my silence. You only have 96 hours from the time of reading this message to do this.
Okay, 96 hours, it's a good sales technique to put a deadline. 96 hours, let's see, 24, 48, 4 days, okay. Jeez, I just think that most of the pedophiles out there, you know, given 4 days, they might figure it out. I think you need to narrow this time down to 16 hours or 24 hours. I like the 24 hours. It sounds like a TV show and it's a really nice, you know, deadline for the payoff.
If not, I will make these videos public and distribute them to your family, your colleagues, and the police.
Finally, the actual threat. Your family, your friends, the internet, the whole world, and the police. If you're a pedophile, you probably understand that you can get arrested. And that's a crime that puts you in prison for quite a while. And of course, the embarrassment of your family and friends. On the other hand, you know, probably if you're part of a pedophile group, your family and friends are, you know, not going to be all that offended. In fact, they might want to get a copy of the videos. Also, a brief warning for the extortionist here. It's illegal to possess a video containing that sort of child pornography. So as a result, you're exposing yourself to the potential of being arrested and put in jail and being counter-extorted. Once they figure out who you are, oh, hey, anonymous, note this. Once they figure out who you are, they can reveal you to the police and you'll end up getting arrested for having those videos. Oh, I forgot. There are no real videos. My apologies.
You have to pay via Bitcoin transfer. If you don't have enough Bitcoin, research how to buy Bitcoin and transfer it to me. You can use online exchanges such as Coinbase, Binance, or other to buy Bitcoin.
Okay, and just so we all understand it, you know, Bitcoin is the preferred monetary instrument of all extortionists, fraudsters, and other similar criminal organizations, as well as those wishing to illegally transfer funds across international borders. So, you know, just a shout out to Bitcoin. Also, just to note that Coinbase and Binance are, well, legitimate might not be the right word, but for Bitcoin trading platforms, they're legitimate. They're not the ones that are created by the other extortionists just to steal your money when you have Bitcoin and are using it to get interest or transfer it for other purposes. So it's a subset of the Bitcoin fraud groups. It's not the whole Bitcoin. You know, my goodness, of course not. Those are huge.
One Bitcoin now costs exactly 31,500 British pounds. So send exactly 0.080267 BTC to the address below.
Of course, it's vitally important that we give you the information to seven digits, because, you know, that's on the right of the zero, 0.7 digits, because we wouldn't want to overcharge or undercharge. On the other hand, the value of Bitcoin changes with time. So, you know, it's a little bit, oh my goodness. Maybe what they should do is just ask for one Bitcoin and make it seem like less, even though it's a heck of a lot of money.
Copy and paste. Note the upper and lower case. Transfer 0.080267 BTC to 3CNKA8CXQP9RVEQFUSBB4SKHHUDVR2V5ZJ.
I just thought you would like to know the entire specification. You're not going to be able to type this accurately into the Bitcoin magic thing to do the transfer. You're going to want to copy and paste it, so they provide you instructions on copy and paste, because I guess they have, you know, previously extorted people who used up her case for everything and they were unable to get the money out.
Remember that you only have 96 hours to do this and you have to transfer the exact amount of 0.080267 BTC, 2,500 British pounds.
Because if you send me more money, I will not accept it.
If you send the Bitcoin transfer, I will forget the whole thing and remove the virus from your device and we will never see each other again. But if you don't do it, I guarantee that your family and all your friends will be amazed by your fantasies. Don't cheat.
The threat made explicit.
I keep an eye on you.
And the fear factor increased.
You only have 96 hours from the time you received this message.
The deadline repeated.
I will be notified when you read this.
And I will know when you actually get it, so don't try to cheat that way.
If you have problems to transfer or buy bitcoins, I may give you few more days and will contact you again.
But I can't pay the rent. But you must pay the rent.
But I have to see that you are trying to buy BTC to send me the money.
But I can't pay the rent. But you must pay the rent.
Because I have access to your devices and data, I know a lot about you and I know that you earn well.
No, you can't. Yes, I can.
So don't try to fool me, because I know that you can afford to pay.
No, you can't. Yes, I can.
I send the details for the Bitcoin transfer below.
The threats get a little repetitive here as they go around this list two or three times.
I am waiting for your transfer.
And I suppose you're still waiting, and you will be for a long time to come.
You should better pay, otherwise everyone will find out about your deviations. Anoni.mo.us, we do not forget. Expects us.
Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book Fraud, Spies, and Lies and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET and you press on books. Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Pete Herzog can best be characterized as a hacker. He's been a hacker since he was young. He's been on both sides of the line between good and evil, if you will call it that. And his career has affected a lot of people, all the more so since he started working on open standards and Hacker High School. Here's Pete.
Well, maybe if it's
I don't know if I did. I don't know if I did that for personal gain. I was always very fair. I would trade things. I would trade services or cigarettes, or I was never trying to manipulate somebody to do something for me. I don't think I was into
well,
that.
No, you were always manipulating people to do things for you. We all do. That's the nature of, you know, human communication. Right? It's the notion of the social contract that we are in an exchange with each other. That's what the social contract is. I do this for you, you do that for me. The question is whether it's outside the normal bounds of the rules.
See, I think manipulation is more that they don't get anything out of it. That's how I see it, that I am taking something from them without them realizing they're getting nothing.
But they are getting something for it. It might not be an appropriate exchange. They may get a feeling of love or friendship or a momentary feeling that they're doing something good. It may turn out, you know, really bad for them. That's a bad part of it. But I don't think people do that without feeling something good about it. You know, if you're extorting from them, they'll give you the money because, you know, they're trying to reduce their loss. Right. My point is theft by deception, you know, taking, you know, by lying, that's illegal.
Yeah, that's manipulation, right? I am manipulating by lying my intentions.
Sales is also manipulation, right? Even if you're doing it for the well-being of the other person, it's still manipulation. You're communicating with them with the idea that they're going to do something they otherwise would not have done. I can say, look, here's salt. You know, you need salt to live. If you drink too much water without salt, you know, you get sick. So you need salt. So here, it costs $1 for this thing of salt, whatever it costs. Okay, yeah, I'll buy it. That's not deception.
That's not manipulation to me. But that's not manipulation. See, manipulation is buy this salt because if you put it on a bracelet, your arthritis goes away. And then they buy it. That's manipulation.
All right, so for you, in order to be manipulative, it has to be a lie.
I think so, yeah.
All right, so we'll agree to disagree about the definition of manipulation and go to the dictionary after the show.
I am going to look it up, yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I'll probably play it. Let me look it up, and we'll just have a minor cut to find manipulation. The action of manipulating something, a skillful manner. That's useless. All right, so you know what? Manipulation is defined in terms of the word manipulating. So we have to look up manipulate, which is handle or control. Right, so you manipulate a tool when you screw a screwdriver. That's a manipulation. Alter, edit, or move on a computer. That's manipulate. Examine or treat part of the body by feeling or moving with the hand. Right, so that's what happens when you go to a
chiropractor.
Control or influence a person or situation. Cleverly, unfairly, or unscrupulously. So cleverly isn't unfair or unscrupulous, just being clever. That we're now into the second definition, the third part of it. Alter or present statistics so as to mislead. Okay, so manipulation itself is not inherently nefarious.
Okay, so the willingness to go into infinite depth about definitions, that's a characteristic.
Well, and it's, as I said, you know, I said this before this, you know, I recorded another podcast with a mutual friend, Richard Thiem, and it went long, you know, solid 33 minutes, right? We've got to keep it, you know, 20 or so, but you know, so much to discuss. And it's the same stuff, you know, totally different topics, but, you know, it's the same stuff. Let's, you know, the words and definitions, you know, Richard, you know, was a pastor for many years, a Presbyterian, I believe. And studied, you know, words, right? You know, and Pete, you know, has had his past. You and I have had ours and so forth. But we all come together around this desire to define, you know, what exactly are we saying? You know, because if you don't know that, then you can't build good structures, right? You know, intellectual structures, cyber structures, or anything else, right? So, yeah, we will debate the meaning of it.
I just love it that the internet is so convenient for looking up a definition. You know, it used to be you'd have a dictionary on your desk and you'd go look it up, and it's so much faster on the internet. Except then we get to the problem of definitions, which is that manipulate is defined in terms of manipulate. So all definitions, all such dictionaries are inherently circular, right?
Well, you look at the changes over time with the Encyclopedia Britannica. You know, that was the authoritative source when I was a kid. You know, get it, you know, and you look things up and so forth.
dictionaries, the published dictionary. But as the careers you and I and Pete and our peers have had, you get involved in these groups where they're defining what words mean, and you realize that's all there is, right? You know, the words mean what we think they mean, right? And we're only so many generations into actually writing down the definitions of all these things that even just speaking to each other, much less getting computers to speak to each other in regular ways that are always, discernible is a fun task.
And yet we don't seem to have a great problem communicating with each other.
But we're humans. We take in all that context. You look at AI, the way it is today. And it was you, I think, that is on a call just this week. A lot of the possible futures are probable in various ways. But we typically underestimate what it takes to be human and understand your entire context and all that means that we do casually every day. We marvel at the gymnast or the, ice skater. Who practices and finds out what physically we're able to do, like literally stand on a little point and spin at that speed and come out of it in the perfect time, which is all a matter of control systems and thought, right? And we do this naturally. And the computers, maybe they catch up someday, not as close as you think.
Well, this thing about just having a conversation with another person, we seem to be able to convey something about our states of mind and our thought processes about potential futures. I mean, images of whole future worlds that we can communicate with each other in a few words that are not well heard, right? You don't hear what's coming out of my mouth because of the noise and such. And my brain certainly isn't reflected in what comes out of my mouth, right? And then it goes into your ears, which are imperfect, and it somehow gets into your brain. And yet we seem to both be able to understand the thing we're talking about. And there's something semi-miraculous about that. And computers most assuredly can't do anything like that yet.
No. I mean, I like to look in the distant futures. I think, we can architect ourselves and figure all that out. Biology, physical longevity, when we're done studying medicine, because that is a point somewhere in the future. It's not an infinite thing. We will at some point, however long it is, get to that point. I think we can replicate our thought processes, but as usual, I think we're not as far forward as we think. We are fascinated with the stuff we can do today. However, that's not people.
So this goes to the question that we were discussing actually yesterday afternoon on this call that has to do with the, threat to the future of humanity from AI manipulation and using psychological methodologies to cause people to, fall under the trap of the computers are in charge or the autocrats are in charge because they have a better computer. It's not a debate I particularly want to have today because I'm not sure that either of us is prepared to even start to examine all the possible futures here. However,
there are a lot of them.
I'm not worried.
I'm not worried either.
So we're fools. We should be worried.
Having worked with big governments and big corporations, I will say, that I find people's, optimism that these large organizations really have the capabilities, that they think they do is charming. No, right. And same with, science and technology and computers are amazing today. It's amazing what they can do. However, right. They're not at the Hollywood points we quite often think of in our minds. Here's a look back and say, wow, how primitive was that? We're not near the end.
There I was in prison. And one day I help a couple of nice older gentlemen make some free telephone calls. They turn out to be, let us say, good family men.
Organized crime?
Don't kid yourself. It's not that organized.
Right. Right. There was a great triads, in Canada in the 80s, 90s, whatnot, but there's a little watching Canadian television and there's this, chief of police of some sort there. And a reporter asked that question very eagerly. It's like, why we are the very well organized, very well funded. And there's this blank look on his face for a second. He says, well, there's another really well organized, well funded group involved here. Us.
And we don't have to hide.
Right, we're not hiding. Oh, yes.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
We're talking with Rand Waltzman, who has a long history in the cybersecurity and artificial intelligence arena, and perhaps most importantly in the deception, counter-deception, influence operations, counter-influence operations, and related areas. Here is Rand.
Okay, we're back with Rand, and you were talking about, you know, some complex mathematical issues, and I can't even remember all the sequences of words to say them properly, so we won't do that. But you were also talking about an information theory having to do with disinformation, a disinformation theory.
Yeah.
And so after your dissertation where you weren't supposed to pursue that and you were doing it in the background, what happened with that?
Oh, well, I continued to work on that throughout the years. I mean, just myself for fun. Yeah.
After the show, let's have a conversation about that one, because boy, do we have some discussions in that arena. But let's go through your career. So you get your PhD. So then what's next?
Well, the day after I got my PhD, I went to DARPA.
And you become a program manager?
Yes, because I was already. Well, I wasn't the age of a student. I was a little bit older already. A little bit older than a student. So, yeah. So I ended up becoming the program manager. I took over what was known then as the DARPA Image Understanding Program, a computer vision program, which was the longest running program, I believe, in DARPA history. It ran for 25 years.
How many of those years were you in it?
Well, I was there for a couple of years. So we were a whole succession of program managers. Yeah. And in those days at DARPA, it was your job as a program manager when you were leaving to hire your replacement.
Aha.
So things worked in that DARPA today is a completely different than they were in those days.
Of course.
In those days, there was very little bureaucracy. I mean, it was compared to now. Okay, DARPA compared to, you know, other agencies is very little bureaucracy, but compared to the way it was in those days.
Yeah, I wish that I had been in that system in those days, but I never managed to get into that system in those days. But one way or the other, in that time frame, I mean, I worked on some, you know, little vision stuff, you know, just for practical applications, but there was a lot of work over a lot of years to try and get vision.
Yep.
And so you're in your chunk of it, you're a couple of years there. So just give everybody a sense, what kind of budgets does DARPA have? First of all, what's DARPA's mission and what kind of budgets do they have for programs like this?
Well, my budget, I mean, the computer vision program was about, I don't know, it was somewhere between $10 and $13 million a year.
Yeah, so at that time, that's like, you know, hundreds of millions now, right?
That was a lot of money in those days, that's for sure.
There you go. So, but you don't do the research yourself as a program manager. No, you're other people apply.
Yes. And what really is the killing about that, you know, I would, you know, give some guys a contract. And, you know, these are really well-known people, top people in their fields, everybody, you know, really good. And then people would call me up. These guys would call me and say, look, what do you think we ought to do here next? I said, what the hell are you asking me for? I mean, I'm a bureaucrat sitting here. What do I know? You're the guy. That always amazed me when people did that. And then, you know what? When I told them that answer, they were always seemed amazed to hear that result. Because, you know, I guess a lot of program managers or some program managers, they think, you know, they come from the field. And so they want to, you know, they give their opinions. They think, well, here's what I think you should be doing. Or sometimes that could happen. And I guess they've all suffered a little bit of that now and then. So, but I thought
that, you know, as somebody who's not a program manager, I thought the idea was that the program manager sort of has a vision for where they're trying to go. And all the people that are doing the work for them are part of realizing that vision. So weren't they just asking you what you wanted to see your vision or not?
Well, sometimes, I mean, you know, and that's okay. But it was, you know, vision at a very high level. But, you know, but not to get into the details. You know, here's two experiments we should run. Which one do you think would be better?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you want to know, what do I get to know about it?
Yeah. Well, so by the way, we're now talking about the vision for the program versus the program, which was about vision. So
yes. Yes, absolutely.
But just sowing confusion in the minds of our listeners.
Yeah.
So, all right. So after that, so you don't stay at DARPA as a program manager indefinitely, right? Those are short stints.
Right. And they're temporary jobs. Yeah. They're all temporary jobs. Nobody's permanent there.
Yeah. So then what happened? Well, hang on. DARPA's mission is to avoid strategic surprise. Was that the mission then?
Yeah. That was always the mission from the beginning. Yeah.
There you go. All right. It was ARPA and then became DARPA and then again became ARPA. And
yeah, I went back and forth a few times. It depended on the politics. You know, some people, there was always an argument about dual use technology. So some people believe that, you know, a technology that you develop for military purposes could just as well be used for civilian purposes. And that, you know, that ought to be taken into consideration. And then other people said, yeah, no, we're not interested in civilian applications. We're only interested in military applications. So the ARPA was for those who, I guess, really thought about dual use. And the DARPA was for those of you who were really focused on military.
All right. So today it's DARPA. So now we know where their focus is, right?
I guess it's hard to say, really. It's, you know, it's all, there's no simple cut and dry answer to any of it. It's all.
Yeah. Well, but it's all individuals, right? It's all program managers who find something that rings true to the structure that they work in, get the funding to do that, and then proceed.
Yeah.
Right? It's not, people think of the world as an amorphous thing where some magical process decides it all, but actually it's people, right?
Yep, absolutely. It's all about the people. I mean, the behavior of the agency reflects the people involved. It's not only the people at DARPA, but it's the people who, you know, outside of DARPA that DARPA has to answer to. I mean, you're right. At the end of the day, it's all about people, but the people are all over the place. It's not only at DARPA. There are other people you have to consider too.
There you go. A mathematician in charge of a bunch of scientists doing scientific research, and it's all about the people.
Well, you know, doing the show with you and a lot of the forums were in the one you host on Thursdays and the other podcasts you do for SciBeats and so forth. You did our 55th today, you know, and interviewing people, you know, with the show, we tend to get generally an older crowd we've been talking to, but it's the same sort of pattern. Right. And yeah, you know, so it sounds a little cookie cutter to say it, but this is who we are. Right. A bunch of folks who follow these nonlinear paths, but you follow them step by step, they make perfect sense. But if you look at the beginning and the end, it's like, wait, you started, how did you get from there? Well, you see, there was this long process.
When you say step by step, it makes perfect sense to me. Step by step, it makes no sense at all. It's like, I'm walking down the street and then a car comes along and I see a girl. And then, you know, it's like, what? Oh, what? I don't. Yeah. And you look back at it and you say, you know, what a long, strange trip it's been, right?
Right. You know, so much of life is like that, right? And, I think of all the working groups and standards committees and so forth that I've been involved with over the years. And it always strikes me that, you know, particularly when you have a first draft of something. So, you know, I've been co-facilitating the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency in the Department of Homeland Security's Software Bill of Materials Sharing Working Group. You know, for a bit over a year now, and we're just right now going to be publishing a document shortly. You know, that's be out this month in January, or February. You know, that is, you know, defining the roles and considerations of SBOM sharing. You know, so if you were involved with Software Bill of Materials, you're either the author who wrote it and you want to share it. I mean, if you write it and don't want to share it, none of our business. If you write it and want to share it, then you have to look at the, you know, your role in this thing, things you need to consider. And if you're a consumer, if you want to get a SBOM, a software bill of material, you know, then here's your role in that, in this whole sharing part of it. And here's what you need to consider, you know, on your way to get that. And we defined this new term, a distributor. So if you're a distributor, you're kind of in the middle. And I think most organizations in supply chain, software supply chain security are in the middle. You know, you're the integrator that built the system and sold it to someone, but you didn't build all the parts. Or the manufacturer who built a lot of the parts, but you didn't manufacture every single component, sub-assemblies and chips and all sorts of things were made by somebody else. You know, there may be, it's not three steps in a supply chain, you know, 8, 9, 13, 72, who knows, right? So anyways, we've gone through this process, defined these terms, we'll publish it under the auspices of a U.S. federal government, public-private working group, you know, people will adopt it or not or whatnot. And it starts with 40 people on a call that split into a subgroup of 5 people who draft something and present it back to the group for comments, and you change things and so forth, then you publish it. Now, was the initial draft even right? You know. Anyways, I guess the point that I'm not making here is that it is just amazing me how well we do in this field and so many others without, it's not our arbitrary scientific stuff. It's a couple people just thinking it through, trying to debate about, you know, the terms we use and the structures, you know, we're going to come up with. And then 30 years later, it's, you know, well, no, that's IETF standard, thus and such, and 17% of the global internet is built around it. Who knows, right?
This reminds me of the effect of gamma rays on the man on the moon marigold.
Right.
You know the movie. All right, that's fine. And we hope that the listeners, if they haven't seen it, will go out and watch it. You can probably find it somewhere on something. But just the title, when I was young, the title sounded like, you know, this is like the title of a scientific paper of some sort. The name of your committee sounds like the title of a scientific paper, right? The subcommittee of a committee of the somebody's, right? And it blows through your brain. And within that committee, then there's this other level of complication. Within that complication, there's this other level of complication. You get down about 18 levels of complication, and then you say something. And the complexity of the world we live in, the extent to which these structures are complicated and intertwined, is astonishing. The ability of human minds to work in that way, at that level of depth, on that level of minutia, and then come up with something cohesive across the board that works at all, is in the realm of spectacular.
It really is. It really is. So each of these folks, you know, Rand, you know, because again, it does make sense. The whole career makes sense if you really understand it, right? You know, because, you know, and some of the times it literally is. I was going from this building, I was walking across the street, and I literally just ran into this thing. And so for the next 7 years, I did that. But you really were on that building. It really did happen. And you had all these choices from you, and they coalesced around this one.
Which I don't know if we've talked about the place I used to stand at San Diego National Laboratory. So we had that discussion yet?
I don't think so.
Well, because I wanted to talk about the deference to people in power and this power differential between the person with the funding and the person who's getting funded. And the fact that Rand says, well, no, man, I mean, I don't know anything about this. You're the expert. But they're all being deferential to him because he has the money. And the notion that somebody who knows more, has more expertise, is better equipped to make a decision, will defer to somebody who knows less, is not particularly good at that decision, doesn't really know what they're talking about necessarily, because they're in charge. I think that's a major problem with the world. And I don't know what to do about it. I'm not proposing that there is something to do about it. I just note that I think it's bizarre. All right, that's thing one. Thing two is this notion of dual use. And man, cybersecurity, everything's dual use. I mean, you know, there is nothing that you can know in the arena of, because cybersecurity is inherently about conflict. So in any conflict, there are always, you know, oppositional forces. Anything you know can be used in a good way or a bad way. And trying to find something where that's not the case is very tricky and difficult. Occasionally, we come across those things. And if they give us good leverage, that's the other thing. You need good leverage. So it has to be safe and it has to have good leverage. That becomes a gem. Deception for defense is one of those things that has tremendous leverage, benefiting the defender over the attacker. And if applied carefully, it has a lot of safety margin in it. So that's one of those rare things that you can sort of tell is going to be huge. Identity management, same thing, this enormous financial leverage, reduction of cost and time and effort, increase in reliability, right? It has these couple of properties that are critical to its success. So, San Diego National Laboratories, because obviously I'm going to tell the story. I just wanted to say something less interesting along the way so people would fall asleep. So, when I was at San Diego and Livermore, California, if you look at this campus, there are a bunch of roads within the fence. You know, it's a fence with razor wire and so forth and a perimeter, and you can't come in if you're not authorized. And so people within the fence are in different offices that are in different buildings on this campus. And they walk across from place to place from time to time. They go to lunch, you know, they go to meetings and so forth. I found a location where I could stand leaning up against a tree. So I was in the shade because it's hot and sunny in Livermore. You just stand there leaning against the tree. And from about 11 to 1, everybody you would ever want to talk to about anything will pass in front of you. All you have to do is stand there. And I could get more done in a couple hours standing there than I ever could have done by making phone calls, trying to go to people's offices, trying to visit and so forth. It's wonderful. So I think to a large extent, there are these places in the world, there are these times in the world when all these things happen.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Next week on The Cyber Show, Pete gets into bank fraud, computer repair, bending the law, and more. Rand becomes a revolting professor and wins the revolution. Another pitcher bites the dust, more fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.